For us now is to restore law and order and bring Hong Kong back to harmony. That is the number one issue we've got to tackle. It's a matter of great concern.
The protesters are calling for the resignation of Hong Kong's pro-Beijing chief executive, Carrie Lam. Lam says she will not step down, nor will she agree to an investigation of police brutality against the protesters. For more on all these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Joe Palca, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Out of the 50 most food insecure countries in the world, 31 are in Africa. That tells it all.
That's Gilbert Hungobo, the director of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, talking about food insecurity in Africa. Details next. Also, Libyan military strongman Khalifa Haftar is being blamed for an airstrike on a town hall meeting that killed at least 42 people. An American Nobel Prize-winning author, Toni Morrison, has died. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, hundreds of stakeholders in Africa's agriculture sector have argued that conflict, war, and climate change are worsening food insecurity on the continent. Ugenu Imana has more details.
Food security on the continent has worsened since 1970. And the proportion of the malnourished population has remained within the 33% to 35% range in sub-Saharan Africa. The fast-growing populations across the continent will bring millions more hungry mouths to feed. The Africa Food Security Leadership Forum in Ghana's capital, Kigali, forecast on how to address the very big concern. Ghana's Minister of Agriculture, Mukeshimana Jardine, was among those attending. The problem is due to climate change, which caused the drought, floods and civil wars and conflicts in many countries in Africa. To achieve food security has become like a dream in the past 3 years. Gilbert Hugenberg, the director of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD, says more efforts must be put into the agriculture sector or the continent will remain hungry forever.
And therefore, we need to really have a specific action for our continent. And out of the 50 most food insecure countries in the world, 31 are in Africa. That tells it all. So we really need to step up our effort. We need to invest on different level of productivity as well as the transformation so to minimize the food waste and loss.
Reducing hunger also will save the lives of young Africans who flee dire situations at home, then die trying to get to what they see as greener pastures in Europe.
Because most of the people who are going, you can say around 30% to 40%, is really related to how to feed your family. What is your future? How to have access to jobs? So if we have a strong and robust agricultural sector, I'm sure that it will occupy a number of young people, a huge proportion, so it will reduce also the temptation to go overseas.
The problem gets worse in countries which are in the midst of wars and other conflicts. Such conflicts make it hard for aid agencies to get food to the needy. Abebe Haile Gabriel is the Assistant Director General of the Food and Agriculture Organization.
Central African Republic, the DRC, many places in Africa, Nigeria, Northern Nigeria, Cameroon. Yeah, you see, the problem of conflict is that even when food is available nearby, you cannot move it.
The Malabo Declaration, signed 15 years ago, commits African countries to allocate 10% of their annual budgets to agricultural sector to strive for food security. But experts say this policy has been short in implementation. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Sudan's military rulers and the main opposition coalition, the Forces of Freedom and Change, have reached an agreement paving the way for a new transitional government. The deal provides for a joint civilian-military council to oversee the formation of a transitional cabinet and parliament to govern for a little more than 3 years until elections can be held. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the prospects of a successful transition to democracy according to the terms of this agreement.
I think the prospects remain very tenuous. While there has been some effort made to put together a division of responsibilities and address some of the details of what a power sharing agreement would look like, there's still a lot of questions. The agreement set up three councils, a sovereign council, a legislative council, and a council of ministers. But division of responsibilities between these different councils is unclear. Moreover, the military will be able to appoint the leader of the sovereign council, which is seen as the main power-wielding authority, at least for the first 21 months. And so it remains unclear just how these actions are going to translate into further democratic change. I think some things we're going to want to look for are just how respected certain democratic rights that were spelled out in the agreement are being upheld on the ground. You know, rights of assembly, rights of expression, freedom of press, the continued restoration of internet access, those types of things I think will be some signals to whether there is some continuing commitment to the transition.
With such a long transitional period, the momentum of street protesting could fade out. Is there any threat of a counter-revolution in Sudan given the power of the military?
I think it's very real that that there can be counter-revolution. In fact, it's not apparent to me that the revolution has fully come to pass. You know, the military has held the key levers of power all along, and they continue to do so. And it isn't apparent to me that they have resigned themselves that they are going to have to genuinely share power. All along in these negotiations, there's been a sense that they are at least verbally agreeing to some sort of power sharing. But in practice, that hasn't yet come to pass. In the end, they always have insisted that they hold the supreme position of whatever transitional arrangement has been under discussion. And so it isn't clear that the military, who has effectively been ruling Sudan for the past 30 years, has accepted the need to share power and to ultimately transition power to a civilian.
So what do you make of the rising role and power of General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, the deputy head of the military junta, and his continuous contacts with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi?
Well, I think this remains the key issue of concern for a democratic transition in Sudan. General Dagalo, more commonly known as Hemeti, has a long history of leading the Janjaweed in Darfur, and he has been alleged to be behind severe human rights abuses and war crimes, you know, burning villages, torture, extrajudicial killings, rapes, not only in Darfur, but also in the conflicts in Blue Nile and southern Kordofan states. And he was also, you know, leader of the rapid support forces that had led the violent crackdown against protesters in Khartoum. He's known as a very, violent leader, yet he has been growing in political influence during this transition over the course of the year. He has personally accumulated a lot of wealth from his ties to, you know, livestock industry and gold mining in Darfur over the years. And so he's been using that to exert more influence with tribal leaders and other political leaders in the hope of try to enhance his influence in this political transition. And so I think he intends to continue to play a very influential role. It's not out of the question that he could be appointed the head of the Sovereign Council. He has the support of some of the leaders in the region, namely Saudi Arabia and Egypt, who would very much like to continue to see a military-led government in Sudan.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Libya's UN-recognized government is blaming military strongman Khalifa Haftar for an airstrike on a town hall meeting that killed at least 42 people and wounded 60 more. An official says more than 200 local dignitaries were gathered Sunday to settle social differences in the town of Marzouk when it was targeted three times. Haftar's forces had no immediate comment on the attack about 550 miles south of the capital, Tripoli. Haftar launched an offensive to take Tripoli in April, but it has mostly developed into a standoff. The Gambian government has ordered the release of three soldiers who told the country's Truth, Reconciliation and Repatriation Commission that they committed gross human rights violations during former dictator Yahya Jammeh's regime. They admitted to involvement in the murder of journalist Dida Haidar, the massacre of 50 West African migrants mistaken for rebels, and two Gambian Americans, among other killings. Reporter Panderambai has the story.
Justice Minister Abubakar Tambedi told a news conference yesterday that the soldiers would be released pending the outcome of the TRRC proceedings.
The decision to recommend the release of the three men who have been in custody for over 2 years and a half now has not been an easy one for me, especially considering the victims and their mourning families. But I cannot shy away from making decisions because they may be unpopular. I have a responsibility that compels me to consider all relevant factors in making decisions.
The soldiers were part of an assassin team created by Jammeh called the Junglers. They have admitted to torturing and executing political opponents, including army colleagues. Tambedu says their testimony shined light on atrocities committed during Jammeh's regime.
Let us just pause for a moment and think about this. Without the revelations by these three men, we probably would never have established the facts about which they testified on a first-hand account basis. We would have continued to rely on second-hand or even third-hand accounts. These three men have so far provided us with the most chilling details about several incidents under former President Jammeh.
Tambedi also clarified that the soldiers' fate will be decided at the end of the TRRC proceedings.
Let me clarify from the onset that the recommendation to release the three men is not an amnesty, as some claim. This is totally false. It is only the TRRC that can recommend amnesty in appropriate cases. At this point, the objective of the release is to put the three men in a similar situation as those who have appeared at the TRRC and admitted to participating in human rights violations and abuses.
Gambian human rights activist Pa Samba Jau says he's disappointed by the release.
I have heard the minister argue that their release does not tantamount to an amnesty, but I don't understand how anybody can justify confessed mass murderers, because these are pretty much serial killers, people who have murdered close to 50 people. To be just released in society, I think, is the wrong move. And I believe it's also a demonstration that maybe this government is not very well interested in justice, but wants to force reconciliation on Gambians.
Jau says he also doesn't think the government is committed to pursuing justice, making true reconciliation impossible.
I believe that in as much as I love to reconcile, but I believe that reconciliation without justice amounts to an insult to the victims. And I also believe very strongly that this government, especially President Barrow, has demonstratively shown that they have little or no regard for the victims. If you call it political expediency, that may be a correct thing, but I also believe that they lack the political will to ensure that there is justice for the victims.
The government's move to free the soldiers has created mixed feelings. Some Gambians believe the soldiers should have been charged, but Tambiri says the government cannot afford to preempt the outcome of the commission. He urges victims and the public to be patient and give TRRC a chance to finish its work. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
19 past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. American Nobel Prize winning author Toni Morrison has died. Her publisher confirmed she died Monday night at Montefiore Medical Center in New York. Born in Lorain, Ohio, Morrison broke many barriers during her lifetime. She became the first black woman to win a Nobel Prize in Literature in 1993 for her novels. Morrison was best known for her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Beloved, as well as her other works, Paradise and Song of Solomon. Over her six-decade career, she wrote 11 novels, 5 children's books, a song cycle, 2 plays, and an opera. Morrison was 88. Nigerian technologist Chenanya Ude wants to ensure schoolgirls learn information and communications technology for summer. Ude says she's trying to boost gender parity in technology in Africa's most populous nation, where less than 20% of women are involved in the industry. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Girls between the ages of 5 and 17 chatter at a tech-based facility in the city's center, where they converge to learn skills that include coding, animation, and robotics for 1 month this summer. The program known as the Smart Girls Tech Camp was conceived by Nigerian female technologist Chinanya Ude. She says she's tackling gender inequality in Nigeria's tech sector with this project.
So what we are trying to do is that how can we girls get these girls abreast? How can we let them know that it's important that technology, they get involved in technology no matter how little? The knowledge is very important both in their daily lives, in their business, and in their careers moving forward.
Nigeria's Bureau of Statistics says women occupy only about 20% of the technology sector. The Smart Girls Tech program hopes to improve that. The program targets 1,000 young girls every year and prepares them for a future in technology. Tech expert and instructor Onyedima Onyekachi says progress has been made so far.
From where we met them and where they are now is not the same. And we discovered that is as a result of psych. There was a notion that girls don't like tech. But we discovered that girls actually are enthusiastic about tech. It's just the approach, just the way technology is being introduced to them.
For young girls like aspiring animator Damilola Ojo, technology could be their entry to a booming market dominated by men.
When I was younger, I was very interested in cartoons and the way they were made. So when I searched up, usually on YouTube, I looked at that it involved ICT, and so I became more and more interested.
10-year-old Ruby Dike, who is more interested in robotics, says it could have several applications.
Let's say I'm able to program a robot that can help in the house. I'm able to program a robot that can control global warming.
Nigeria's ICT industry is among the largest in Africa, and it keeps growing rapidly. It has evolved into a multi-billion dollar industry within the last decade. However, it is characterized by low female representation like many other sectors. People like Ude are breaking the norms with tech programs for young girls. Although it could take a while before this translates into substantial female representation in the industry, it is making an impact on the girls. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
A South African group of teenage pilots who flew a self-assembled aircraft across Africa are back in South Africa after tragedy struck the expedition. The two experienced adult pilots manning the support airplane accompanying the teens died in an accident in Tanzania. The group left South Africa in June as part of a non-profit UDream Global's inspirational Cape to Cairo crowd-funded project that saw a group of teens build an aircraft and fly it from South Africa to Egypt and back. Marzi de Klerk reports from Kyalami, South Africa.
Safety has been an extremely high priority since the beginning of the UDream Global Cape to Cairo initiative. On the bitterly cold mid-June morning of departure, Des Werner and Werner Frunemann made very sure everything was packed. Just over a month and a half later, the two directors of the non-profit UDream Global were killed during the organization's Cape to Cairo expedition. Their Sling 4 plane reportedly went down shortly after taking off in Tanzania en route to Malawi over the weekend. Ethel France, editor and owner of the African Pilot magazine, has been following this initiative ever since the founder of UDream Global, 17-year-old Megan Werner, pitched the idea of teens building a plane and flying it from Cape Town to Cairo to the Commercial Aviation Association of South Africa.
It's difficult to speculate on what happened, why it happened, other than I understood they had an engine failure. My take of Des Werner is that he was a highly qualified airline transport pilot. I understand he had something like 15,000 hours under his belt. I was really looking forward to the homecoming party in which we could celebrate the achievements of Megan and her friends. And I'm just so sorry that it's ended in this tragedy.
According to UDream Global, Werner and Frunemann were on their way to join up with the UDream Global team pilots and their self-built plane in Malawi. They were all on their way back to South Africa.
At this stage, I don't know which one I'm covering because it's from packing boy to flight management to photographer to videographer. And somewhere along the line, I have to actually fly the plane as well.
Officially, Frunemann was the UDream Global project director and coach, but he wore many more hats during the expedition. In June, Frunemann said he signed up for the mission because the initiative changes lives. But the journey was not always easy.
You need to have a positive attitude. You need to take the right positive actions and take action, not just sit back. And have faith, because there's no way that we could have seen the problems that came up. There's no way that we could have known the solutions when we started.
I was too lazy to study biology, and then my imagination started going. And then I was like, okay, let's fly a plane across Africa.
UDream founder and team pilot Megan Werner is also Des Werner's daughter. She initiated the project to show other young people that dreams can come true. At the maiden flight event of the self-assembled UDream Global plane in South Africa shortly before the journey to Egypt started, Belinda Werner and her husband Des talked about the expectations for the trip.
I think any mum is concerned, or any mum and wife is concerned.
And wife.
would be concerned. But, you know, me being in aviation as well and being exposed to all sides of aviation, I think I'm happy that they've chosen this industry to get the message out there that anything is possible, because that's what we believe as a family as well.
On the UDream Global Facebook page, the families of the deceased pilots requested respect for their privacy during this trying time. Marisa de Klerk for VOA News, Kyalami, South Africa.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
Thank you.
Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.